From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Yes, indeed, it is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we are pleased to welcome in Kathleen Domingo, who is the Executive Director of the California Catholic Conference, which represents all the bishops of the state of California. Kathleen, good day to you.
Hi, Bob. How are you today?
Doing very well, I think. I always say, you're doing well until you're not.
That's absolutely correct, yes. Well, hopefully we'll continue.
Yes. I have a smile on my face, so it's a good...
Fantastic.
A good day to be alive. Well, so California Catholic Conference, and we recently interviewed Molly Sheehan, who is the new Respect Life Director, and... what an impressive resume she has, and it's just, I can just tell she's just raring to go.
Absolutely. Molly is a great asset to our team. She comes from the Catholic Conference in Maryland and has some really great experience there, and just really brings a kind of a fresh approach to the office that we really needed, some definitely a younger face and a younger voice. But she loves working on issues related to young people and really has a heart for foster youth and for trafficking victims and for, you know, some folks on the margins that we really want to be working with and advocating for more than ever at the Catholic Conference. So we're excited to have her with us.
Yeah, and, you know, I remember a few years ago when some of the trafficking statistics came out, right here in Sacramento was one of the center places of it. It was stunning.
Absolutely. I don't think there's anywhere in California that's really immune to human trafficking. And it's one of those things that, you know, unfortunately, it's really easy to sort of forget about or overlook as we kind of live our day-to-day lives because we don't really see evidence of it every day as we do with, you know, something, say, like the homeless crisis. Instead, it really takes place sort of in the shadows. And very often it's children and sometimes very, very young children who are involved in sex trafficking in the United States. And then also, you know, really everyone is aware that or should be aware, too, that there's people who are trafficked from other countries, brought here, forced into labor, forced into servitude in a way that is really not in keeping with human dignity and just really forced to live in unspeakable situations, right here in our own cities, in our own buildings. I know when I used to work in downtown Los Angeles in Koreatown, that was also a hub, you know, and on a daily basis, when I would drive into and out of the office and I would drive through the neighborhoods there and I would look up into some of these buildings that I drove by and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm certain that behind some of those windows and behind some of those doors, there are people living in unspeakable circumstances.
Wow.
And it was just an opportunity to pray, right, to always just offer every moment and say, okay, you know, show us, Lord, please, how we can help these folks and how we can do better every day to just keep these people, these most vulnerable of our brothers and sisters in the top of our minds so that we can see and find and create opportunities to help. So that's one of those issues that I think the bishops have really expressed an interest in doing more, more outreach, more engagement, and definitely more advocacy to see what we can do. And it's also an issue in California that really brings people from across the aisle together. No one wants to have human trafficking, especially sex trafficking of our youngest children in our state, of course. And so it's really a good opportunity for us to have those conversations and bring people together and share our values and of course, our love for our neighbor and human dignity, but also really hopefully see some good results as we can work together on those issues.
Boy, let's hope so. You know, so many of these people come allegedly voluntarily. They think they've been promised a job or something like that?
Absolutely. So very often that's the case, and it's really predators that prey on people who are desperate, people who are vulnerable, people who are really looking to escape a terrible situation, very often a dangerous or even life-threatening situation. And sometimes they're traveling with small children. And so they you know, are looking for a way to get into the United States, and they are easily preyed upon by people who essentially just say, you know, give me more money than you could reasonably be willing to part with, and your documents, and I will take you safely across the border. Mm-hmm. And folks who are vulnerable and desperate sometimes find themselves in a position where they think that that's their only hope. And they get here and realize that these people do not have their best interests, and the promises don't come true, and they don't get their documents back, and they're not paid, and they have no way to pay off the debt that they've incurred. And it really is indentured servitude. You know, we think about that in Middle Ages and years gone past, sure. But yet it's really happening right here, too. And so everything that we can do on the labor side and on sort of that economic justice side for those folks, but then also the other side, too, for the children who were taken and who were trafficked as sex trafficking victims. It's kind of two different sides, but mm-hmm. sometimes they overlap, especially as unaccompanied children cross our borders, too. Very often they are, so it's kind of a situation where they're almost mixed up in you know, both halves of this problem. And so we're really looking for ways to work with the folks at our borders, but also work right here domestically with law enforcement, too, and find out what we can do to really help people who have been caught up into this crime that's being enacted on them, and what we can do to help survivors, and how we can help people out of that lifestyle and out of that that horrible situation they find themselves. And we know that one of the very best ways really to work at the prevention side is for people to open their hearts and their homes to foster youth. Because mm-hmm. unfortunately, so many children who age out of the foster care system, if they don't have a family that they can count on who has taken them in, will find themselves victims of trafficking, because unfortunately, they are very vulnerable to that kind of people preying upon them. And so so that's one thing that's really positive and wonderful that our church community can do, because so often trafficking is just one of those topics that's so big, and we say, well, how can we possibly affect change in something that's so mm-hmm. big and massive and worldwide scale? But it really is just one person at a time that we can help.
So in terms of people would age out at age 18, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And you're mm-hmm. suggesting we need somebody who's willing to still take them or have them live with them past that age?
At every step of the process. Uh-huh. The earlier in a child's life that we can have some really positive intervention through even a mentor, through a fostering family, through any kind of intervention in that child's life of someone who is a positive influence, who will be a really stable and loving person in that child's life, the better. But yes, even in the older teen years, even into young adulthood, if children who age out of the foster care system have someone, and again, it could be a mentor, a big brother, big sister. It could be, if they haven't found that forever home in that family that's actually taken them in permanently. Any intervention that's positive coming from someone who is a trusted adult who can mm-hmm. help them navigate is going to dramatically reduce the likelihood that they will fall into some really bad situations.
Is the CASA program, the court-appointed special advocate, is that helpful in that way?
So CASAs are fantastic, yes. So you're right. It's called the court-appointed special advocates, and those are people who volunteer their time. There's a training process. But some people feel a little bit intimidated. They say, well, I don't know anything about the law. I don't know anything. But if you've raised children, or if you were raised well yourself and so have that experience in your background, you can be a CASA.
Sure.
And being a CASA for a youth in the child welfare system is just a fantastic and wonderful use of your time. And again, that early intervention and that really meaningful relationship that someone can provide to a youth who may not have any real stability in their life can entirely change the outcome of that child's life, change their life trajectory forever. There was one time, Bob, that I was very early on in my career of sort of working on all of these social issues, that I was at a presentation, and there was a woman from actually an organization called KidSave, and she was describing the children that she was working with in the child welfare system, and she said something I will never forget. She said that sometimes when a mentor from her organization goes and spends time with a child who is a foster youth in the child welfare system, it is the first time in that child's life that an adult has ever shown them love or care.
Wow.
Who was not paid to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing? That's astounding. I remember, and still, even when I say that, I get goosebumps, and I think, oh, my gosh. I mean, the privilege that we have had to grow up in loving families and that we hopefully are sharing with our own children, and yet some children have never had anyone pay attention to them without being paid to do it.
Wow.
So we know that there's a lot that we can do to really help these children's lives. It's a lot to ask for people, but the folks who get involved with foster youth and at any level, as a mentor, as a CASA, as an actual foster family, find it so rich and rewarding. And then our parish communities and our entire communities can rally around them and offer all of the support to help them in this wonderful but difficult journey.
Do we have a good foster care system in California?
We have a very strong fostering system in California, yes. Now, the Catholic Church isn't involved in fostering
right,
in California
right.
Any longer, unfortunately. But there are some very good Christian agencies and some faith-based agencies that we've worked with who really understand sort of a faith-based family and why that's important to have for especially for children in the child welfare system who maybe have never encountered unconditional love before, right? Mm-hmm. And how a family, especially a family of faith, without ever imposing their faith on the child, can at the same time sort of bring that love and those Christian values and this gospel message to the child that they're working with. So again, whether it's through a mentoring process or a CASA or even being a foster family, you can share that love and you can share that joy of being a Christian with this this young person and help them to really see that there is this wonderful way of living and loving that's kind of different than what they've encountered before. And so the foster programs throughout the state have been very helpful. We work with a number of them to really just reach out and make sure that our parishes are aware, and very often they'll come in and give presentations in the parishes. And we always just say, you know, there's someone in the parish that God is calling or God is putting on their heart to work with foster youth. It might not be you, and if it's not you, it's okay, but there is someone in this parish, we know. And so the more we just talk about it, the more opportunity we have for people to answer that call.
Amen. Yeah. So on a completely unrelated topic, I was very encouraged when I saw the commutation of the sentence in Oklahoma, the death sentence. Probably a very unpopular decision, I'm guessing, on the I know the conference doesn't work in Oklahoma, but I know you do work on the death penalty.
Right, right. I agree with you. I was very pleased with that outcome. Of course, it was a very hopeful outcome, and I think, very merciful outcome. And so we're very pleased with what happened, and we really hope that that's a trend that will continue. In California, we still do have the death penalty. We've tried to get rid of the death penalty in California several times, mm-hmm. and it just hasn't worked. The laws surrounding the death penalty in California are actually more complicated than in some other states, but there are some things that we can do. And so on the horizon, we're looking to try to find ways to actually limit the way that sentences are structured. And in a very particular way, we're looking at the possibility of making sure that people who have cognitive disabilities mm-hmm. and even dementia are not eligible for the death penalty, because right now in California they still are.
Right.
And so, you know, really opportunities like that to kind of chip away, maybe we can't overturn it overnight, but we can certainly chip away and we can shine a light on the fact that, look, some of these situations are just so egregious. We should not be having state-sanctioned killing for someone with dementia or for someone who really has cognitive disabilities and you know, it has a difficult time making decisions and things like that. And so I think if we really shine a light on the human dignity of each of the individuals and in a particular way kind of try to chip away and help people understand what our faith teaches about mercy and why that's important in this situation, I think we're going to make some progress.
Boy, I hope so. You know, any time I see a commutation of sentence, even though that, you know, he still served life in prison without possibility of parole, if he is truly innocent, and I don't know much of the details of his case, if he's truly innocent, maybe he'll. I presume he's pretty much exhausted every avenue available. It's been 22 years, but still, I think that it may be, maybe it shines a light to the rest of the country that this is a better outcome for anybody on death row.
I agree. I think that's all we can really hope for at this point, right? And it's tough to know, looking from across the country, and not all of the details are known about everything, of course, but I agree with you. The more that we have these kinds of outcomes, I think the more that the appetite of the nation will be that we're just not interested in imposing the death penalty anymore and imposing sentencing that requires that. You know, we don't have to have that anymore. And hopefully people will start to see that. And I know Pope Francis has just done an amazing job of really encouraging that teaching, developing that teaching, helping us to really understand what that means in light of our faith and in light of our pro-life commitments. And so I'm really hoping that that will be something that we can really see a significant change in the next few years, hopefully.
It all goes back even to Cardinal Bernardine and his seamless garment.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, well, we're hopeful on that. Kathleen, so what's on your plate today?
Well,
there's many different dishes there, I'm sure.
Many different dishes. You know, we are looking forward to a new legislative session. It's the end of a two-year session with the legislators here in California, and so we have some unfinished business from them. But we're also looking at, you know, a lot of really positive things. We have this huge budget surplus that we're facing in California, which is a good thing, right? And so kind of trying to figure out, you know, what we do with that. We're looking also, again, still at the reality of COVID in our life and what that might mean for our businesses, what that might mean for our schools going forward, and really helping people to understand access the vaccines as much as we possibly can, our children now as well. And really, you know, hoping to carry that message of care for the common good in throughout that process. And then we're looking forward to some wonderful things. There was, you know, the Bishops' Conference that happened, and there were some really positive things, I think, that came out of that, a real understanding that it's a moment for a Eucharistic revival, as they called it, and looking ahead for that possibility. We're still in the middle of the year of St. Joseph, which is wonderful, too, so we have wonderful devotions taking place and some action around that sort of in our parishes, right?
Right.
Some wonderful devotions. So the church is alive and well. We're doing a lot of things. And this is a moment of a little bit of calm, I would say, before the storm, before the legislature comes back, where we actually sort of try to have some refreshment ourselves during these holiday months and try to do some strategic planning and try to figure out, you know, what is it that we really want to do. The bishops met, the Bishops of California met in October, and as part of that conversation, you know, I mentioned human trafficking is something that was a big issue for them. So was really working to support families. That was something that really came out that they're very interested in working on. And we're also very interested in continuing our commitment to working toward environmental justice here in California and having some really interesting conversations around what does that look like, not just in our urban settings, but also in the rural settings.
Sure.
So much of our state are agricultural areas and rural communities, and what does that look like in those areas, and how can we bring that beautiful theology of creation and in that understanding of conservation, but also of nature and creation displaying the glory of God, and how do we share that with other Californians when so much of the conversation really can be contentious around environmental issues, right? How do we bring that teaching in to our conversation? So there's a lot going on, and, you know, it's really a wonderful moment, I think, to be determining how we'll take our next steps and how we bring that gospel message into our legislative action.
Very good. Well, you know, I know the governor's got $31 billion in his back pocket. I told him I only want a billion. You know, he could spend the other on everybody else. But, yeah, well, Kathleen, it's always a joy to talk with you, and we'll look forward to getting back together perhaps in the new year when we get more balls rolling, if you will.
Oh, I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about once that legislature comes back. They hit the ground running, and then we do too. So, yes, we'll have more specifics at that time. And now just, you know, looking forward to everyone having a wonderful Advent and a preparation for Christmas. And I hope everyone gets a little rest, because it'll be a busy winter and spring.
Indeed it will. Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Of course. Thanks, Bob. Take care.
Yeah, take care. That's Kathleen Domingo, who's the executive director of the California Catholic Conference, and that represents all the bishops of California, primarily to the state legislature. So she's relatively new and is really doing a great job for the bishops here, and so many issues, of course. Now, we had a chance to sit down by phone with Molly Sheehan, who also works for the California Catholic Conference, and she's the new Respect Life Director for the California Catholic Conference, and a lot of issues on her plate as well. And we're going to bring you that interview now. Pleased to welcome in Molly Sheehan, who is the new Respect Life Director for the California Catholic Conference. The conference represents all the bishops of the state of California and is located right here in downtown Sacramento. Molly, good day to you.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, good to hear your voice. We haven't met, but I've been reading all about you and your new position. Tell us, first off, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're a native of Sacramento?
Yes, I grew up here. My home parish was Presentation, mm-hmm. so it's good to be back home. And after college, I worked for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, organizing their Walk for Life for a few years and just working on pro-life issues and social justice issues there with the churches. And then I went to grad school in Washington, D.C. at the John Paul II Institute, and I studied theology of marriage and family and just loved that. And while I was there, I was interning on Capitol Hill, so I got to learn more about the political side, and most recently was lobbying for the Maryland bishops. But I've just moved back to my hometown, and yeah, really happy to be back.
Wow. And because you wouldn't say it, I'll say it. You graduated magna cum laude with your master's from the John Paul II Institute.
I did. It was, yeah, a real blessing to be able to study there. So wonderful time.
You get a halo for that, or what? What do they do when you?
you get the words, and they're like, okay, go have fun.
Now go find a job.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Here in Sacramento, we go to the Walk for Life in San Francisco, the West Coast Walk for Life in January. But we all know about One Life LA, the Walk for Life down there. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so it was a real blessing to me. Right after college, I started working and helping organize One Life LA, and One Life is really a celebration of the beauty and dignity of human life. And so because it's in the center of culture, which is Los Angeles, you know, the goal is to celebrate how good it is that we are here and that dignity of the human person is recognized. And so from womb to tomb, right, from beginning of life to natural death. So people walk through the streets, and there's just this really joyful and excited atmosphere, and people have their signs, and then we end at the Los Angeles State Historic Park, and there's salsa music, and we have fun speakers, and there's food trucks, and people can sign up for service, because the goal of the event is for it to be a catalyst for change in the community. And so it's a really wonderful thing. I found it really informative, and a lot of people talk about how One Life helps them to understand what it really means to be pro-life, that this is an invitation for everyone to see the goodness of human beings. So, really beautiful day. If anyone has an experience and lines up in L.A. around that time, they should go check it out.
Is it coincide with Roe v. Wade, or is it separate from that entirely?
Yeah, so it's intentionally near, so the Saturday closest to the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Right, to really just emphasize that, you know, we recognize the humanity of the unborn child, and that we want to build a society as God sees it. So that would be one where there is no abortion, where there is no, none of these issues that are attacking the dignity of the human person. Instead, really seeing these are the human beings that are most vulnerable, and that we will defend, and that we will celebrate.
And when you work for the Maryland Catholic Conference as a lobbyist, so you're working with the Maryland legislature, not with the D.C., or did you work with, in the Capitol as well?
So at the Maryland
U.S. Capitol, I mean, right.
Yeah, Yes, I understand. So at the Maryland Catholic Conference, we were focused on state legislation, so I got to know the Maryland legislators. But prior to that, I had interned in both the U.S. Senate and for a caucus. And so I got to work within the Capitol building itself and, in the Senate offices and get to see kind of the other side of the desk, see what it's like to, receive the phone calls. And, so I can tell people that if they call their senator, there is an intern sitting at that desk that answers your call and records it or texts that voicemail or writes down every single email that you send. So, those calls do get answered and your voice does matter. I can tell you that because I did that job. So.
Well, I know that the conference, the California Catholic Conference, will frequently put out alerts saying we're concerned about this bill, we're concerned about that bill. Call, email, whatever, text your assemblyman or woman or your state senator. And it's good to hear you say that matters. And I know it does matter from the people I know in the legislature. They say it might not be a direct result of an exact number, but if something comes in 10 to 1 against something, that's going to wake them up.
Absolutely. Yeah, you do take notice. You notice what the people are saying, and every single contact of a constituent, so if you live within that district, every single contact that you make with that office gets recorded. So they have the whole record of everything you've ever sent them because they want to know what their constituents think. And you're right, it may not be that, if you email about this one bill that you want them to oppose, they may still be in favor of that bill, but they learn from the amount of emails that they get and from the arguments that people make, and so maybe they might not push as hard on it. Or maybe they'll not introduce a similar bill next year. Or maybe they'll be a little softer on it. Or
maybe there'll be an amendment of some sort that softens. Yeah, like
exactly.
it's funny, there have been a number of times in my life where I was pretty set on an issue. I wouldn't say that on abortion. That one, I can't imagine anybody would change my mind. But where listening to an argument, there are times when I've had to say, "Oh, I hadn't looked at it that way." It doesn't mean I flipped, but it does mean I went, "Oh, yeah, I need to consider that." Because sometimes you go off on a tangent and you think this is great legislation or this is great whatever, And if you hear from other people, not just that they're opposed to it, but why they are, it can really open your mind and make you, probably a better legislator, number one, a better human being, number two, but also willing to compromise or maybe even change your mind because you just hadn't viewed something in a certain way.
Definitely. If you hear from someone who is speaking to you briefly and calmly and really kindly, that has a huge impact. And if they hear your experience and your story, if you personally have experienced something like this, but that goes a long way. But even if not, as long as you just say, "Hey, I'm concerned about this and I'm your constituent and I just urge you to oppose this or I'd urge you to support this," that can be so helpful to them just to hear that perspective. And they really do want it. I can tell all of the listeners that, yes, your legislator wants to hear from you. And if you get a form letter back, I know some people get upset when they get a form letter. Mm-hmm. They're like, "Oh, they didn't really read it." But the staff in the office had to write that form letter. So someone had to take the time to look at your conversation, and maybe lots of other people are having that conversation. It was important enough for the office to spend a lot of time to put together that form letter. So know that whatever you're saying to the legislator gets heard, and it does have an impact.
Yeah, and it's just so important because legislation changes our lives. And so much legislation, not a lot, but every now and then there will be something that becomes law that's actually named after one person and their experience, like Megan's Law, where it somebody had a certain experience and the legislators could relate to that and actually passed a law. It doesn't always mean it's a good law or it's a bad law, but frequently it's based on somebody's story that they heard.
Absolutely. Yeah, our stories carry a lot of weight. And I think just being able to give that personal touch, just saying, like, hey, this is something that I've experienced. And for those reasons, I'd really urge you to support, you know, helping foster kids or supporting pregnant moms or whatever mm-hmm. your story might be. The way that you share that story, you know, especially if you do it kindly and briefly and concisely, but just by telling that, it goes a long way. It really, really does. So I just want to emphasize that for everyone, that it matters when you call your legislator, and so don't stop doing it. And if you get an alert from the California Catholic Conference, you should reach out to your legislator and let them know that what your opinion is.
So with your job title now, are you not specifically a lobbyist?
No, I am. So my job is to...
You are a lobbyist. Okay.
I am a lobbyist, yes.
Okay.
So I specifically work with the legislators, help to build up coalitions on different bills, and then review the bills that get introduced and see which ones we should be supporting or opposing, and also recommend bills to legislators. Mm-hmm. I'm currently trying to think of, you know, what kinds of things could be done in our state to, you know, support pregnant moms better, or to combat human trafficking, or to help foster kids to find their, you know, good foster families and make sure that those foster families have the support that they need. So those are some of the things that I'm looking into and trying to figure out what can be done here. Because there's always opportunities, and politics is the art of the possible, right? So mm-hmm. trying to think, what is possible? Because there is so much that we can do.
Yeah, I mean, the state of California is very unlikely in the near future to, let's say, ban abortion. But
right.
It does have, apparently it really has a lot of the resources. I just saw a $31 billion surplus. You know, we do have the resources to provide a lot of help to people in need, you know, that might actually reduce, perhaps dramatically, the rate of abortion.
It's so true. You know, if we look realistically at our legislature, I don't think that we're going to be able to end abortion by law in our state.
Right.
You know, other states might do that, and that would be wonderful. But in our state, that's not practically going to happen anytime soon. But it's true. What we can do, and what is within our grasp, very easily, in fact, is to be able to support moms and dads mm-hmm. and babies and families, and to strengthen them, to make sure that they're able to choose life. You know, something that I talk about a lot, Bob, is, you know, a lot of we often hear that it's low-income moms who are the most likely to have an abortion, which is tragic.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also the most likely to identify as pro-life in polls. So, and it's the same thing with, we see a higher rate of abortions for Black and Latina moms, but we also know that Black women and Latina women, according to the Knights of Columbus Marriage Pool, are incredibly pro-life.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
Like, they pull much higher in terms of being pro-life across the spectrum. So when we look at that, it's like, okay, here's what we need to do. We need to be able to make sure that the women that want to choose life are able to. That these women, they want to have a family. They want to have children. You know, especially at a time when we're seeing that the demographic shift, where a lot of women are saying that they didn't have as many children as they wanted to have. Well,
right.
that's tragic. And so I think in our society, with the kind of wealth that we have here in the United States, it's possible for us to support families and make sure that they're able to choose life for their children and really welcome the children that they want in the first place. Like, they really want to have a family and to love their children. And so part of our legislation really should be focused on building up those families and making sure that they're able to choose life and to choose what is good and virtuous, which is, you know, celebrating the life of their unborn child.
Yeah, you know, I feel like we should have a $31 billion State of California Gabriel project, you know, like let's I remember discussing this with my wife, you know, and all the surplus, and you know, we have three teenage daughters in college, and right at that age where, and I want to say to my daughters, you know, you and they're going to a public university. What resources would there be at this university that we've got resources for just about everything and every condition known to man? But if you got pregnant, they would look at you and go, oh, we don't, here's the number of a clinic, you know, that would be their response to you. You'll probably have to drop out of school, and you definitely can't be on the volleyball team, and you may have to change your major. And, you know, I mean, it would be, everything would be negative. There would be no resources for them to go to. Like I say, any other problem you're having on campus, they've got an office and full-time people to help you through that problem. But if you happen to be pregnant, forget it. You know, it's not pro-choice. It's no choice.
Yeah, you know, so it's interesting, exactly what you're saying. So a couple of years back, California passed AB 809, which requires that all public universities list the rights of pregnant parents and students in their health center and at orientation, and clearly marked on their website. Because from our research, we found that California colleges, most of them didn't have that information available. And so exactly what you're describing was happening, that students would be, you know, told, well, you can't take time off to give birth. If you, you know, don't show up for the test, well, you're going to fail the class, right?
Right.
Or, you know, just honestly be thinking, oh, I guess I can't finish my degree. I'm going to have to drop out of school. And that's actually against federal law. And so California passed a law to say, listen, you need to be able to make sure that they're aware of their rights, that all pregnant parents and students have these rights, and that they can't be discriminated against, and that if a mom chooses life, she needs to be able to be supported throughout her pregnancy and as a parent on campus. But one of the effects of the law is, you know, the law exists, but not all campuses have implemented it yet. So something I'd encourage, if anyone just, like, has some spare time and they're hanging out, check if your local college, public campus in California has Title IX rights listed on their website for pregnant and parenting students.
Mm-hmm.
And if not, you can let them know about this law and say, hey, you know, these students deserve to know their rights. This is California law, and it's also just a good thing to do to make sure that our students are supported and assisted and able to achieve their educational dreams.
Yeah, it's one thing, though, to not discriminate against anyone and to give them a list of places off campus where they can get food and housing and support and probably the Catholic Church and et cetera. It's another thing to affirmatively, for a campus to affirmatively provide resources that itself. I mean, I look at, like, you've got 80 guys on a football team at the University of California, and one of them struggling in math. Well, they get them a tutor right there on campus, provided by the campus to help him pass math. Or are they doing the same thing for a student that is having difficulty because, you know, they're in an unwed pregnancy?
Yes, I think you're right. The kind of supportive services that a student mom would need are different, and they are varied. And yeah, it's one thing to say, well, we'll just post your rights and that's it. But the best campuses are the ones that, you know, they make sure that the child care is available
there,
for
right.
single moms,
right.
and that, you know, they have family housing on campus. And some of them, I know UC Berkeley actually has a really great student moms organization. And so they, you know, they welcome all of these student parents and support them throughout their journey and just make sure that all the resources they could need are available on campus. And that's what you want to see. You want to see
exactly.
that universities are welcoming, not just not discriminating, like you said, but welcoming to students who have children. And, you know, they want to be able to study and get their degree and, you know, be the best parent that they can be. And so schools should absolutely be supporting that. I think that would be the ideal for any university is to support those students, including the 10% of those students who are parents.
We're talking with Molly Sheehan, who is the new Respect Life Director for the California Catholic Conference, which represents all the bishops of the state of California. Molly, in your job description, Respect Life Director, obviously when you see Respect Life, people think abortion, but it's a lot bigger than that, isn't it?
Yes. So I have a large portfolio. So, you know, if we're saying womb to tomb, my portfolio kind of covers that. So I am tasked with lobbying on the beginning of life, end of life, human trafficking, foster care, religious liberty, the death penalty, and also family support, as well as marriage. That's a lot of different things. So I'm trying to join all of the coalitions in California and contact all of the different organizations that are working on these issues. But it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see how many different ways that the Catholic Church is involved and how many different ways we can pass laws that benefit people and really do help them to flourish.
Yeah, you know, all the work that the conference does in so many different areas, it's one of the things that makes me proud to be Catholic and proud to proclaim that I'm Catholic. A lot of people, they hear you're Catholic and they don't know much about it and they don't have much to say, or maybe they even say something negative, you know, and you go, well, wait a minute. Do you realize what the Catholic Church does in this society? Do you know all the things the Catholic Church does for good? Can you imagine what our country, our state would be like if the Catholic Church had never existed? We'd have a lot of people falling through the cracks.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Catholic Charities is the number one provider of social services in the country outside of government assistance.
Right.
And, you know, our Catholic hospitals serve millions of patients every year. And especially in rural and low-income areas, you know, our Catholic churches, they provide so many services behind the scenes that no one knows about, as well as, you know, providing the spiritual care that we need to get through our day and our refuge on Sunday to go there. And our Catholic schools, they have been masterful throughout the pandemic. So those are just a few of the things that the Catholic community does. But we really do answer the call to feed the hungry and give drink to the thirsty and to, you know, clothe the naked and visit the sick and in prison. Like, we do all of those things. And, it's true. That's why I love being Catholic is, you know, we really do answer the gospel call. And there's always room for more. So in my job, I get to look at what else can we be doing, what else can we advocate for, how else can we improve society and respond to that gospel call.
God, who, you know, I look at who's doing the resettlement of Afghan refugees in Sacramento, Catholic Church. Who's helping with immigration clinics and teaching people about citizenship and learning to speak English, et cetera, Catholic Church. It's just it's a million different things that the church is doing and not patting itself on the back for doing it. I would think working with the California legislature and all those things you list, you know, obviously abortion, pro-life policy, human trafficking, domestic violence, disability, end of life, death penalty. You have to be on both sides because probably not one person in the California legislature that's on the same page with the church on every single one of those.
It's true, and it's actually something that I enjoy, is that, you know, I get to go into these meetings and talk to legislators, and we're not going to agree on everything.
Right.
But I get to bring in this beautiful Catholic social teaching that really shows the dignity of the human person at every stage in their life, and that there are various attacks on this human that we need to defend them against. And so from you know, the unborn child to, you know, the traffic victim to the person on death row to the person at the end of their life, like, this person is valuable and they matter. And so in my job, I get to advocate for that one human being throughout their life. And I love it. And I think, you know, for legislators, a lot of the time, the work that we do, you know, you're like, okay, we're not going to agree on this issue. That's okay. But we can agree on this. And if we can agree on this one issue, then let's work together on that. And so doing that, you can get a lot of good things done on behalf of the dignity of the human person and really recognizing, hey, I mean, if we can do something about homelessness, let's do it. If we can do something about human trafficking, let's do it. And if we can do something that helps pregnant moms out. Let's do it. And I think a lot of legislators from whatever political party and whatever their views across the spectrum, because we have everything in California, whatever their views are, there is common ground there that can be built around assisting human beings in need, because we all are human, and there's that common thread that we all want to do what is right. And even if our views are wrong, we can bring truth into that conversation and say, look, this is what it means to support human beings, and I'd love for you to join us on this.
Yeah, sort of the seamless garment in the extreme.
It's the idea that this is building up a culture of life. This is what that looks like. This is building up the kingdom of God on earth. And maybe I won't say that to a legislator, right? But I'll be like, look, this is a human person.
Right.
You care about the poor. You care about the immigrant. You care about the pregnant homeless mom. So let's work together on that. Let's help that person.
I remember a number of years ago, I had a nightly talk show on KFBK here in Sacramento, and just general talk. It wasn't a religious program. It was just general talk, and like most talk shows, it's 3 hours a night, and we get all kinds of callers. So because it was night, it would go all over the West, and so you get callers from Oregon and Washington, et cetera. And so a wide range of conservative areas, liberal areas, and everything in between. And I remember one night, I think it was prior to an execution that was pending, and I gave my views on the death penalty and why I was against it, and a caller called, and he says, well, if you're against the death penalty, how come you're so in favor of abortion? And I stopped, and I said, when have you ever heard me in any way, shape, or form support abortion? He said, well, I just know you are, because you're against the death penalty. And it was just like, it was that dividing line, like one thing meant you were this, like building blocks almost, And I had the chance to explain that, I was against abortion and I was against the death penalty, But it was this knee-jerk reaction that if you're that, you had to be this, And I think it's obviously one of the problems we're having right now, and not necessarily with those two issues, but in our country, it's like one person stands for one thing, it means they bought the whole package.
Yeah, it's true. The polarization has really, tribalism has made it really difficult for us to have a conversation.
Yep.
But I think that there is opportunity if you frame it around the human person and not the political party that you belong to.
Yes, yes.
Especially as Catholics, because for us, our job is not to necessarily belong to a political party, but rather to call on the parties. For us as lobbyists for the bishops, our job is to call on the parties to become more Catholic, right? And so as Catholics, we're frequently at this both and, right? We care about justice and mercy, right? So many different things. So it's just trying to see, all right, how do we convey that in a way that's winsome and that works?
Yeah, it's so... It gets tested every day. I know, just personally. And nowadays they televise murder trials. And you feel yourself just this animosity building up toward the person that committed this crime, if they did, and yet at the same time, when it comes time for sentencing, that mercy part comes in. It's almost like they're struggling back and forth.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for the concept of seeing that human being and seeing, them, the truth of who they are, right? So that they've both committed this horrendous crime, and then that they're also made in the image and likeness of God, right?
Yep.
So being able to hold all of the truth about a person, I think, is very difficult for us. It's much more easy to put them in a box and say, well, they're just the worst thing that they've done, right? And it can be really, really bad. But even this person is made in God's image and likeness, and we know that they're loved by God too, as was the victim in the case of murder. The victim and their family deserves every kind of healing and support. And then we need to look at the offender and see how we can try and help this person to repent and change their life.
Yeah, that's the one thing that always saves me when I go too far down the path is say that that person right there that I'm having trouble with is made in the image and likeness of God, and God loves that person like I love my own children, probably way more than I'm capable of loving my own children. But God loves that person. It may be hard for me to accept that God loves that person because I think they're because I've just watched them, you know, and whatever bad thing they did. And that's what we always have to keep foremost in our minds, though, is that they too are made in the image and likeness of God.
Amen. Amen. It's so true. It can be hard, you know, just being able to extend that personal forgiveness and mercy. But it's also, you know, it's also the Christ-like thing to do. And not to ignore the faults of the other person or, you know, in the case of someone who's committed a serious crime, not to ignore the crime that they've done, but to acknowledge the truth of that. And then also to be able to extend that forgiveness.
Molly, what's the toughest part of your job? Where are your brick walls?
The toughest part of my job is, I would say it's when I'm facing a bill that is, you know that you're not going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, I'm going to fight this because it's right, but I know that I'm not going to win it. And I read this article, and I think about this a lot. There's an article by a guy who played for the Washington Generals,
mm-hmm.
and they're the exhibition team that always plays against the Harlem Globetrotters.
Definitely not going to win.
No, the Globetrotters get to win and show off and play all of these cool tricks every exhibition game, and the Generals are required to lose. Like,
right.
That's what they're paid to do, to make the Globetrotters look good. So one of their players wrote this amazing article about how he would take wins out of every single required loss that he had just because he loved the game of basketball. So I think about that guy a lot, and I'm like, all right, how do I take wins out of the things that the bills, even that I know that I'm going to lose, right? Like, this bill, it's going to pass, and I'm going to be upset about it. But maybe I can get some good media out of it, or maybe I can get some really good education out to our folks about this. Or maybe I can win over one legislator that I can go back to in the future, right? Or maybe we can soften it a little bit. So there's ways to take those wins. I think that's the hardest thing, but it's also sometimes can be one of the most fun things is trying to figure out how to do that.
I want to find that article because not only did the Washington Generals were they paid to lose, but they were real basketball players. These guys were good college basketball players, and they, you know, they weren't good enough to play in the NBA, so they signed up for this tour. They get to see the world and have a lot of fun, but they were good basketball players, and they're losing every single game, you know.
Yeah.
And
the guy who wrote it, I guess he played in the European League as well at first, and then transition to being Washington General. And he just wrote about how much he loves the game. And I just resonated with me. I thought it was a beautiful story. So for all those who feel like you're losing out there, you know, it's great to try and figure out a way to get some wins out of those losses.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Molly, it's a pleasure to finally talk with you. And our prayers go with you. You have a tough job to do. I'm glad you're doing it and I'm not. God's blessings at Thanksgiving to you and all your loved ones, and hopefully our paths will cross again soon.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Molly. Take care. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
And I From the fear.